I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today's Wednesday, March 20th. Members present are Representative Hannan and Representative Reback, Representative Fields, Representative Tallarico, Co-Chair Ledoux, myself, Chair Wall. Today we are hearing HB 79. There's some other items on the agenda today, but we will start off with HB 79 and save a few minutes at the end for HB 44 and HB 48. Representative Kopp, I'd like to thank my committee aide, Ashley Strauch, who's here. All communication can go through her. Selman Holland is our current Labor and Commerce Secretary, and the LIO moderator is Taylor Kelly. So let's bring Representative Kopp and his staff up to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill today. I'd also like, Mr. Chairman, if I may, to have Tom Westcott, who has helped me with this with the Alaska Professional Firefighters.
You certainly may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the staff is getting a PowerPoint tuned up right now.
Okay.
For the okay. But while they're doing that, Mr. Chairman, I could just give some opening remarks.
That would be great.
Great. So, Chairman Wall and committee members, thanks for hearing this bill today, which I believe powerfully addresses both themes of this legislature, the public safety recruitment and retention challenge that we are facing right now in Alaska, and the budget, keeping our fiscal house in order. I want to thank the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association, Public Safety Employees Association, Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, and Anchorage Local Firefighters 1264, which have been working for more than a dozen years to come up with a plan that keeps our best and brightest public safety employees here right at home. And God forbid, if they perish, provide their loved ones with a measure of security going forward into the future. I served 23 years as a police officer here in Alaska. It was a great honor to serve communities from Kenai to Anchorage to Bristol Bay in the profession. The best.
All participants are unmuted. All participants are muted.
Mr. Chairman, the best and toughest experiences of my life were on the job. It was certainly hard on my family. It was hard on my police family, but I would do it all again. In this job, you save people's lives. You solve terrible crimes. You help people put their lives back together. And fortunately, or hopefully, if you're in the right place at the right time, you can keep lives from ever coming apart. In this job, you run towards the gunfire. You fight violently with bad guys. You confront evil almost every day. You get hurt, you risk your life, and sometimes you die. Police and firefighters do all this together. We can bicker like siblings.
All participants are unmuted.
But at the end of the day, we're as close as hands and feet. An example I'll give is on December 25th, 2003, when I was working for the City of Kenai Police Department, we had an officer that was killed in line of duty Christmas Day. He was working a shift for another guy so he could be home with his family. So, Officer Watson, where he laid, we could not recover his body because the shooter had a complete field of view and we could not recover him. There was no place for concealment. And we were not able to figure that out on our own. It was the Kenai Fire Department that figured that out. They ran an engine up the driveway, ran it up against the side of the house, and allowed us to recover John's body. And it was not safe, it was not practical, and it was not planned. But they did what was necessary. So police and firefighters, sometimes, whether we like it or not, we're always in this together. And we only get in and out of tough spots together. But the job is harder now. There's less political support, less public support at times, and the media scrutiny is intensely on the public safety profession. There's increased liability for officers and firefighters personally and for their municipal and state employers. The small reward I had for hanging in there through the tough times was a predictable retirement benefit, which has gone away. And now we have what you have seen in your packets is one of the greatest recruiting and retention challenges the profession has ever seen in this state. You will hear from police and fire leaders, chiefs of police of agencies from North Slope to Ketchikan, from Bristol Bay to the Kenai Peninsula, that are losing millions of dollars in training every year when new officers and firefighters leave shortly after being trained and certified to other agencies that have a defined benefit retirement. House Bill 79 takes the lessons we learned from Tier 3, which was unfunded liability due to unaffordable benefits, and Tier 4, losing our employees to others, other agencies, and it brings forward something brand new that avoids the pitfalls of earlier plans. And it provides a sure foundation for employee retirement planning and employer cost stability into the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I may, I would like to turn it over to Tom Westcott just for some opening remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cobb. Mr. Westcott.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Westcott, and I'm president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. I have a few short remarks to make as one of the individuals who's been at this for over a decade now, trying to fix this issue. As Representative Kopp mentioned, the recruitment and retention problems created by Tier 4 are one of the driving factors, and the other is just the benefits provided under Tier 4, especially for the unique nature of the public safety career field. So with these problems in mind, we set out to create a workable solution that took into consideration the concerns of the state, the other employers, and at the same time strive to provide benefits more in line with outside agencies and what they're offering. To create a sustainable plan and avoid repeating the mistakes of the past, it was important to understand how the old system fell short and how most successful plans managed to stay well funded. It's a mistake to think that all DB plans are the same. The overfunded Washington State LEFT plan is not the same as New Jersey, and the fully funded Wisconsin plan is not the same as Illinois, an underfunded plan. There are ways to do this successfully. So as we reviewed what got us into trouble and what the best plans did, we found some common themes threaded through both reviews. Our new plan must be built off more conservative assumptions, have reasonable costs. It must share risk between employers, employees, and retirees. It must offer conservative benefits and have steady, consistent funding. These are the traits of the best plans in the country, and all of these sound practices can be found in HB 79. The current bill is the product of much time and effort. It stands as it is today after years of feedback from the legislature, a lot of work from Senator Kelly and his staff in the last session, much time and effort from previous DOA commissioners and the staff at Retirement and Benefits, and this year, Representative Kopp and his staff. We've been professionally guided over the years by William Fornia, Pension Trustee Advisors, and you'll hear from him shortly. Again, we simply work to incorporate those best practices I mentioned earlier into a plan with reasonable costs and reasonable benefits. You'll hear a lot of these through each presentation, but the big thing that we did in this new plan is we removed health care and replaced it with Tier 4's defined contribution health care, which is an HRA. The old systems had pre-Medicare coverage. This plan does not have pre-Medicare premiums. They're replaced with the HRA. The employees' rates are adjustable, and they cannot go below 8%, but they can adjust between 8 and 10. So if you had a shortfall, you're able to go and ask the employees to contribute more. We installed a minimum age of age 55 to begin collecting retirement, as opposed to the old plans that had, it was just a 20-year requirement. You could be any age with 20 years. We based the final average off the high 5 years instead of high 3. This lowers the benefit slightly. The inflation proofing that's awarded to retirees is optional, and the ARM board will make a determination whether they can afford to give that. If the funding were to fall below 90%, that would not be granted. So it's another way to save money. And we remove the COLA benefit, which is a 10% benefit that the old systems provided that would be removed. HB 79 is the smart, reasonable solution to Alaska's recruitment and retention problems. As you can see, we have significantly scaled back benefits, put in place tools to share risk and deal with adverse experience, and at the same time created a plan that will allow Alaska's public safety agencies to compete for those highly skilled, in-demand employees. As I close, I would ask that as you weigh the merits of this legislation, that you also consider the risk of maintaining the status quo. We have seen an acceleration in departures as the percentage of Tier 4 participants has grown. So we have to ask ourselves also, what is the risk of maintaining the status quo?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To walk through the bill, we have Flick Fornia of Buck Consultants. It's one of the country's premier pension consulting firms.
Thank you, Representative Kopp and Mr. Westcott. I can take a brief at ease so we can get the... call the meeting back to order. We're ready with our PowerPoint. And, oh, you can leave the backgrounds on. Hey, Ashley, can you leave the back of the room on? There you go. Thank you. And you're ready to continue, Mr. Fournier? Are you going to bring it? Oh, is he on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll ask Mr. Fournier to begin his presentation. I incorrectly said he was with Buck Consultants. That's the state's pension.
Right.
He is with Pension Trustee Advisors. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
It's not showing the. Okay, it's coming up. So the audience can't see the presentation.
Yes, we need that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Shall I begin?
Yeah, I can just introduce yourself for the record, and then we can begin the presentation.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Kopp. My name is William Forney. I can see the cover slides there with my name, and thanks so much. I'll be fairly brief going through this because I want to leave time for questions, and you can have this will be additional background material for you all. First of all, thanks for correcting the Buck Consultants mention. I ran the Denver practice of Buck Consultants about 20 years ago, but I'm no longer with them. If we move to the second slide, please, page two. So I'm a credentialed actuary. I'm a fellow of the Society of Actuaries. I have all of the appropriate credentials for pensions. I'm very active in national organizations. I was elected to be on the board of directors of the Society. I've written articles on pensions often, testified often, including to various committees here in Alaska. And I'm a regular expert witness. I was involved in the Detroit bankruptcy, Stockton bankruptcy, and then Puerto Rico as well. We can go to slide three. I'll move quickly through this. I was the corporate actuary for Boeing for 4 years, and then I do have a decent history with you all here in Alaska. In 2005, you hired your first review actuary, and I had that honor for a couple of years when I was with another firm, Gabriel Roeder & Smith. 2009, I did an audit for PERS and TRS for when I was with another firm. I mentioned that I ran the Denver accounting practice of Buck, and since 2011, I've worked for various labor groups in Alaska on this very issue, and I'm excited that perhaps we formulated something that's going to work and going to get passed. I testified, I think, three or four times, both in person and by your video audio site. Conference abilities. Worked for a lot of different retirement systems in various states. Currently, my largest client is the Ohio Retirement Study Council, where I've been working for about 8 years, including their pension reform. And as I mentioned, I've done expert testimony. Other clients, in addition to the states, have been cities, U.S. Department of State, some large companies. So let's go to page four, and we'll get into the meat. So we'll talk about three things: why this change is necessary, the proposed structure of what we call in this presentation PSF, Public Safety Pension Fix, and then I've got some illustration of financial projections. We've designed this Tier 5 for public safety, and it's designed with the overriding objective to minimize the risk of having significant unfunded liabilities. Let me speak up a little bit. So page five is some illustrations of the benefit levels. And the middle column here just shows police and fire. A typical police officer, firefighter, highway patrol, public safety members hired at age 31. They can retire after 25 years, which would make them 56. Under Tier 3, they would have a benefit of 57% of their final average pay. But under Tier 4, we calculated that they would only have enough money to pay themselves 31% of final average pay. This is a reduction of 26% of their average pay that they'd have to find some other way to replace, to live on. If we move to page 6, we'll see an example of that. So the Tier 3 defined benefit on the left is, 57% of pay. It's about $46,000 for an $80,000 paid retiree. But the Tier 4 is much, much less. It's barely half of that amount. And even if they'd only been in Social Security, that's the bar on the right, even if they had no other employment, no other employer-provided plan, and they were in a social, and they were contributing to Social Security for their last 25 years, they would have $21,000. They'd have almost as much from Social Security as they'd be getting from the Tier 4. So as you can see, that's probably the reason you're having difficulty retaining some of these firefighters and police officers and other public safety employees. If we move to page 7.
Can we take a Mr. Forney? Mr. Forney, we have a question from the committee. Representative Ledoux.
So are firefighters, do they get Social Security? I know other state employees, there's something, the state doesn't pay Social Security for its employees, and so it's actually even worse because even if you've worked someplace else before, your Social Security gets deducted for the number of, I don't know how it works exactly, other than that the employees end up in a rather difficult situation. So did the firefighters get Social Security?
You're correct, Madam Chair. They do not get Social Security unless they have other jobs. So they might be getting some Social Security for another job, but then it's reduced because they have this PERS job. So the purpose of that bar was to show that even a private sector employee that has a similar earnings profile to one of your public safety employees, if all they did was pay their Social Security, they'd have a benefit almost as good as what your public safety people get from Tier 4. And they do not get Social Security unless they've had another job. Does that answer your question, Madam Chair?
It does. Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's look at the next slide, please, page 7. I won't spend much time on this. Tier 3 is DB, defined benefit. Tier 4 is DC, defined contribution. And the bullets I want you to focus on are the very top one. The DB plans are more cost-effective at providing retirement benefits. But then you've got the very bottom row. The DC plans are great because they don't have any risk of an unfunded liability to the employer. Alaska, like many other employers, public sector, have gotten burned because their DB plans put a large unfunded liability on the books that needs to be fixed. So our goal is to figure out a way to design a DB plan that doesn't have much likelihood of an unfunded liability that grows, and we think we've done that. Page 8 talks about this program that HB 79 creates, and it's basically a compromise between a DB and a DC. It starts with 12% employer contributions and then tries to manage the plan within that range. There's some ability to increase that, but the idea is to design it so you probably don't have to. We've designed benefits that are a little bit lower than the current level. We built in adjustment mechanisms, and we'll spend a fair amount of time talking about those. And then, as Tom Westcott mentioned, we put in a lower discount rate to basically we want a cushion against adverse experience. Part of the reason that public pensions have had these unfunded liabilities is they didn't earn as much as they thought they were going to earn. So we're going to lower our expectations on what we think we're going to earn in the markets, and that that will provide a little more security. Page 9, please, is just a Tom went through most of these, but I'll do it quickly. Each column is Tier 3, Tier 4, Tier 5. The employee contributions went up a little bit from Tier 3 to Tier 4. We're going to keep them at the same level in Tier 5, but if things don't turn out as well as we expected, they could go up another couple percent. They could go up to 10%. The employer contribution is still going to be 22% of pay, but we're targeting 12% going to this plan as long as things turn out as well as expected. Vesting is still 5 years. The retirement age, Tom mentioned this. In Tier 3, people could retire after 20 years regardless of age. Tier 4, it doesn't really matter. You've got your savings account built up. But Tier 5, you now have to be age 55. So that's going to save some money, as we'll show in a little bit. The benefit multiplier, how the benefit's calculated. Remember that 57% I mentioned a few slides ago? That's the same formula, but now you're going to have to be at least 55 to get that 57% in 25 years. Tom mentioned the final average pay. Also, it's for Tier 3, it's currently based on the final 3 years of earnings. We're making that 5 years of earnings now to reduce the cost a little bit. There's a Alaska COLA. If you live in Alaska under Tier 3, you get a 10% cost of living adjustment because the cost of living is higher up here. We're taking that away. So that's one feature that's, you know, cutting the benefit back. If we move to page 10, similarly, there's a post-retirement pension adjustment, and that's automatically, and it's tied to CPI. We're keeping that in the right-hand column, but only if the plan is still 90% funded or better. So if things start to turn bad, that thing can be suspended. Medical is basically the same as Tier 4. So we're not giving the Tier 5 people a medical that Tier 3 has, so we're keeping them with Tier 4 medical. And disability is kind of in between. I mean, there's a lot of nuances there, but disability cost difference is not significant. Let me move to page 11. This basically repeats some of what we just said. No medical, or no pre-Medicare medical. The funding level, we're using a more conservative rate. We can increase the contributions by a couple percent. We're getting rid of the Alaska COLA. And then the last three bullets you saw. Again, the whole objective with all of these adjustments is to do things to keep the unfunded liability from growing. If we look at slide 12, please. So you've had this Tier 4 in place since, for people hired since 2005, essentially. And so what we're doing is we're saying we'll ask the onboard and their actuaries, or the PERS actuaries, I guess, to create an actuarially equivalent formula. The idea is we don't want to create an unfunded liability. So whatever they've got in their Tier 4 accounts, if they want to be in Tier 5, they have to pay the actuarially appropriate amount. They'll have 90 days to decide. They can use this. They can transfer this if they want. They may not have enough, and if they don't have enough, they can either find more money or they can get lower years of service. In the bottom bullet, we have an example. If they've got 6 years, but they've got $100,000 built up, but the actuary says it costs $120,000, well, for 6 years, they'll only be able to buy five because spend their $100,000 on 5 years of service. So when they retire, they'll have again. Again, the whole point is we don't want to create an unfunded liability right off the bat, and we want to make sure it's not going to keep growing. If we look at page 13, these are just some more precise examples. I think we're better off skipping these for now, and you can ask questions later. Same with page 14. They're just very specific calculations for people. So starting with page 15, we put in what we call these safeguards. You know, again, our goal is to try to keep from creating an unfunded liability. The first safeguard is we lowered the benefits. You know, you don't have as rich of benefits in Tier 5 as we do in Tier 3. You got to be 55. We average your salary over 5 years instead of 3 years. Your benefit doesn't get the extra 10% bump if you live in Alaska, and we don't give you a cost of living, a post-retirement pension adjustment if we're not well-funded. And if we're not well-funded, the employees will have to put an extra 2% of pay into the plan, and the employers might too, depending on the ARM board's philosophy. Again, our goal is to keep from just to prevent the unfunded liability from getting significant. Page 16 is full of numbers. I will just focus on the middle column. Basically, under our 7% return assumptions, which is a little bit lower than the PERS actuary is using, meaning more conservative, less optimistic, we calculate that the Tier 3 would have a cost of 18.4% of pay. Now, we are hopeful that when the fiscal note is done, they will make these same calculations and we'll all be on the same page. There might be a little bit of differential because they're different actuaries, but our goal was to try to figure out what they think the cost is. But then we've eliminated some features like the age, we put in a 55 requirement, we've changed the averaging period, we've gotten rid of the Alaska COLA. So that drops the cost from 18.4% of pay down to 15.9% of pay. I'm jumping a little bit on this chart. Now you recall that the employees are putting in 8. The employers are putting in 12. That makes 20. There's a little more than 3 that go into the health accounts, which leaves 16.9 to go to pension benefits. So with 16.9 going to pension benefits, I think the cost is only 15.9. That means you've got an extra 1% going in already. So if everything turns out the way we expect with 7% returns, you'll grow, and I'll show you that in a minute. But in addition to that, we've got these triggers. We've got up to 2% of cost savings by suspending the PRPA, and we've got up to 4% of savings, of additional contributions if necessary. So we've really got an extra 6% margin for adverse experience, plus the 1% to start with. And again, the whole reason these are here is to prevent the likelihood of growing an unfunded liability. If we look at page 17, that's what we call the second safeguard, is the actuarial methods. I kind of just demonstrated that. You've got a margin, and you've got reserves, you know, would build up an extra surplus. And then the 20% contributions are more than is needed. Page 18, the third safeguard is that we built this whole thing using a reduced discount rate or a reduced assumed rate of return. We're using 7%. I believe the PERS actuary has just changed theirs down to 7.38%. It used to be 8%. So this, again, builds more of a cushion in. The idea is we monitor experience going forward, and if necessary, we would adjust the benefits and or the contributions. Page 19, so we're in the process of doing some simulations, and we've done one already. If the plan earns, the investment return is 6.6% per year for each of the next 10 years, and we picked that because the ARM board investment consultants have that as their baseline for the next 10 years. Then if we have earned 7.38% beyond that, and we pick that to be consistent with what the PERS actuary assumes, that's Buck, then we modeled this, and sure enough, the plan grows. It starts out at about 100% funded. I guess it starts out exactly 100% funded, and grows gradually to 110% funded, and it would never go down. Now, in the real world, we'll have good years and we'll have bad years. So if we look at page 20, basically we're in the process of using more, doing more sophisticated simulations consistent with what the other outside consultants assume.
Mr. Fornia,
our preliminary finding is that there's a decent chance you'll hit some of the 90% funded ratios and you'll have triggers that get you back in line. But there's little chance of a sustained significant unfunded liability.
Mr. Pornia?
The process of doing these calculations, we'll show them to the other committees. Yes, please? Is there a question?
Yeah, there's a question. Representative Ledoux has a question.
So why would you estimate 6.6, I think that's what it said on the slide, for the first 10 years and then 7.38 afterwards? Why would you think that the next 10 years is going to be higher than the first 10 years?
We did that for two reasons. One is to be consistent with what the other consultants believe, and one is that it's more conservative to use 6.6 instead of 7 or 7.38. I personally don't like that assumption. I think that's I've never advised my clients to do that. Now, the reason they think that's reasonable is that currently, you know, like your cash book savings rate right now is about like 1%. The underlying bond market is unbelievably low and has been in recent years. So as a result, the capital market assumption structure is that returns would be fairly low because current interest rates are low. Now, but they believe that they'll pop back up after a period of time. They'll start to rise again. I don't really like that method, but since that's what the ARM board's advisors are using and their actuaries are using, and since it doesn't, you know, it paints a less rosy scenario, I'm happy to use that in our projections too. Does that make sense?
Not really, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, you might want to ask, actually, when I'm sure that you know, the benefits department will be testifying at some point on this. You can ask them that question, but that's their assumptions. I didn't want to use more optimistic assumptions because I didn't want to be accused of making it look better than the other consultants would think it would look.
All right, thank you.
Okay. I've come to a good stopping point. If you look at page 21, I've got four examples of four other states. But it might be a better use of our time if you ask questions now. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'm happy to proceed in whatever way you want. I could get five more minutes on some examples or take questions.
Yeah, why don't we take a little break, ask a few questions, come back to what other states have done. Obviously, there's a lot going on here. We'll have more meetings on this bill for sure. So everyone will have a chance to talk and get all sides heard very well. So. And all the details of this plan. Representative Hannon had a question.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Fournier, at the beginning of your sample work history, you say you were involved with the Alaska ARM Board review actuary. You were the review actuary in 2005-2006, which is the same time that we did away with our defined benefits system. Can you tell me what was your opinion at that time about the risk of going to a DC system in a state without a Social Security backup? Were you the one who sounded the alarm, or where were you in that process of us dismantling the public employees retirement system in 2006?
Representative Hannah, so the timing was not, I came in after the decision had been made, and was really not involved. I mean, I think my views were known. I'm a fairly well-known advocate of maintaining defined benefit plans. If you notice, I've written a couple of papers on the subject. It really never came up. I mean, it was a done deal. And the great news is, you know, even though it's been, what, 14 years, you know, we can fix this. You know, other than the fact that we may have lost some good workers because they wanted to go move to another state with a pension, you know, it's not too late to fix the benefits for these people. The fact that we made this change in 2005, which in my opinion was probably too harsh of a change and leaves public safety employees with reduced benefits, you know, none of them have retired yet, or very few of them would have retired in only 14 years. So I was not involved in your decision to make the changes. And I'm certainly pleased that you might be making some kind of changes to make come up with an interim program that, or not an interim program, but a compromise program that does provide reasonable levels of benefits with low risk of unfunded liabilities.
A couple follow-ups in other areas. HRA, I have deduced, is a health retirement account. Is the entirety of the contributions to it accrued during the working years of the employee, or are they annually contributed to in the retirement?
Yes, the account builds up like a 401k while you're working, and then at retirement, you use that account to pay the premiums for your pre-65 health care.
Okay.
Follow-up.
So public safety employees remain on a 20-year retirement, correct? They're eligible to retire after 20 years of employment.
Are you talking currently or on this plan?
On this plan, there's an age restriction, but after 20 years, they might cease their job. So now they're 45, and they can't draw on their HRA until they're 55. And so what's the anticipated ability to find a private sector health plan that would cover a family for that 10-year span till their retirement HRA account would be available to them?
Representative, I'm not sure. You're talking about if a teacher leaves, or a public safety employee leaves at 45?
I think Representative Kopp wants to chime in on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hannon, it's a good question. So you're right that you have to have 20 years of service. And if you get it in when you're 44, 45 years old, you're talking about the in-between until you're eligible to draw what you do for those 10 years. You would have to have an alternative plan. That is correct. Is that Mr. Westcott?
Through the chair, I would have to check with retirement and benefits. But I think if you're vested in the HRA, I'm not sure that there's an age limit to using it. On the pension side, you certainly have to be 55 to draw the pension. I think we would love to have a system that would provide for anyone, you know, who put in their 20 years. But just due to cost and risk associated with the plans, 55 is a very in the packet we handed out this year, you'll see that's a pretty common age requirement for public safety retirements. Washington State is 53. It started at 55, but their plan has been so successful, they've been able to lower it to 53. But we wouldn't see an individual retiring at age 45 and probably not doing something else at that age.
Representative Hammond.
So in my mind, and I am a strong advocate of all of our public employees having a defined benefit system, and I'm a retiree with that benefit, and praise to Alaska for protecting public employees for the decades that we did, and I think it's shameful that we did away with it. But in the vision for these public safety employees, I envision still that many firefighters are retiring at 45 not because they don't love their job, but because their knees gave out, and that knee replacement surgery, which is going to cost them $70,000, they now know have they would retire but not be able to use their health retirement account unless they wait 10 years, and they're not going to be eligible for that public support for a private sector health contribution unless they don't have any assets, but they've now spent 20 years saving their assets so that they've got a health retirement account starting at 55. So my concern is the reason that our public safety employees have had a shorter window of retirement is because of that understanding of the physical demands that they suffer in their workplace, and many of them are only going to retirement because their bodies gave out, and that we've created a vision of lay there in pain for 10 years till we now have a benefit that can help you with that knee or back or shoulder. But am I walking out a scenario that is fictional, or has that been considered?
I got two people that want to respond, so.
So, Mr. Chairman, a couple things. One, I'd like to hear the actuary's take on this, and we can get back to you with a definitive answer on the bridge as it pertains to health care for those 10 years. And I do appreciate Representative Hannon's passion to see that people have health care. She is correct. This is a young person's game. I still work out 4 or 5 days a week, and I have no desire to wrestle around like I used to and take people into custody. Similarly, I'm sure Mr. Westcott doesn't want to drag fire hoses up 100-foot ladders for the rest of his life. The demands of the job are very demanding. And Tom?
Through the chair, I think you bring up some real legitimate issues. The reality is the HRA is not going to be very sufficient, and Ms. Fornia can talk about this because he's looked at it for us, and the amount you accumulate over a career is really not going to provide very much coverage in retirement. The expense of health care and what it's done to pension systems, because it's grown at such a rate that's outpaced inflation, has caused problems for pension systems to keep up with that growth. We would love to provide that benefit to everybody, but what we really don't want to do is create a plan that establishes another unfunded liability. So while that's a real problem that needs a solution, we're going to have to find another avenue to tackle that. And so I would say, I guess what you're talking about is a real problem, but we're trying to take one step forward, maybe, as opposed to trying to take two.
Yes, thank you. And healthcare definitely is a big driver for a lot of these discussions, especially when it comes to retirement. We had I forget which subcommittee it was because we've had so many, but the person that does the Alaska plan for all of state employees and talking about retirees and changing how they're going to do benefits and how they're going to fund travel for knee replacements, so maybe that person can get the knee before they retire.
Any default at work?
Representative Fields.
Thanks. I was wondering if maybe the actuary could address the relationship between the size of the group being covered and the stability of the plan. Is there a relationship, and if so, what is it?
Through the chair, thanks, Representative Fields. I think either group, this group's big enough. Clearly a bigger group is more stable, but you know, I can't remember, you have several thousand of these people. That's fine. On an actual basis, that's a large enough pool that you get most of the advantage. And the investments, too, will probably be commingled with the rest of the ARM investments. So I don't think there's an issue with size. I think this group is certainly large enough to have a well-functioning, sustainable plan.
Follow up,
Senator Fields.
Great. And why is it that a larger pool is more stable? I appreciate putting it in context that this is a sufficiently large pool, but why does that relationship exist?
Two major reasons. One is what I would call risk pooling. Like if you're a single person and you have a 401k, you don't know how long you're going to live. So you've got to kind of bank, have enough money if you live longer than average. But if you're, you know, 1,000 retirees, the actuaries have a very good idea of how long they're going to live as a group. So that's one thing. And then on the investment side, the large pool of assets just gets you lower fees. You know, everybody's would love to manage the money of the ARM board and are negotiating smaller and smaller fees, as opposed to like when I go out and have my personal retirement savings through Fidelity or somebody, or even Vanguard, that's relatively cheap. They're still more expensive than a large, you know, multi-billion-dollar pension fund would be.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Fields. Is it fair to say that by combining with the ARM board funds that it would reach that threshold of a large enough fund to get a good deal on fees?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would hope that you would have them. I'm with legislation that carefully, but that clearly you want them to be running it. You know, I mean, I've seen other states where each of the local fire departments has their own little pension fund, and they might have fun with it, but it's not a great way to get good investment return. You guys are real pros. So, yes.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So I just want to clarify something here. The problem that is has been articulated by Representative Hannon, that's both a problem in the present system and this plan. So this plan doesn't make that problem any worse, correct?
Through the both co-chairs, yes, Chair Ledoux, you are correct. That's we are picking up with the current Tier 4 health retirement account system, and we're not changing that. I would say an additional that even though you have to look at that 20 years, that's a minimum. Many public safety employees do work 25 years, some longer. That would get them right up to 55. I would say probably the average person would be looking at a five-year gap between time they retire to needing or to being eligible to draw their health and cash benefit. That allows that five-year window basically incentivizes planning when you start into it, that you know you're gonna, you know, you'll have a five-year window, and there are other things municipalities or the state can do, I think, to help employees get through that window. What we are trying to do is not drive up the cost of the plan, and that's just the tough thing that we see here is there are sacrifices to keep the cost down, and we think that the sacrifices made make this viable.
Thank you. And just a follow-up here. So with this health retirement account, do people use that to pay their medical bills, or do they use that to fund insurance?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, I believe it's just an IRS qualifying medical expense, so they list it out, and it could be a premium, like you're purchasing insurance, or it could be you go to the doctor and have a qualifying medical bill, and you could pay for either with the HRA.
So there's really, if you just pay it yourself, I mean, there's nothing to take care of catastrophic health concerns unless you've purchased insurance with it. Okay, thank you.
Representative Hannon.
I'll try to make this a really small, narrow question. How many people are predicted to be in the size of the group covered in the bill as it's currently constructed?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, it should start at about 1,800 people will have the option, and there's a little over 3,000 in public safety altogether. So a good portion of them are tier two or three still working, like myself. But about 1,800 are tier four today. I think when we originally started this, it was 1,701, I think. I'm sure that number has grown a little because those numbers were from the previous session. So I'm going to guess we're in the 1,800 to 1,900 range right now.
Okay. And I guess...
Follow up.
And it is currently written, so it will cover all municipal fire departments, police departments, state troopers, wildland firefighters, covered or not covered in this?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I don't believe, wildland firefighters, if they're state firefighters, believe yeah. They would be covered, but if they're, I don't know, if they're part-time, I don't believe so. There's a lot of seasonals, but they would have to be full-time. Anchorage Airport and Fairbanks Airport, police and fire would be covered. So the international airport system, a lot of people forget their full-time public safety, police, fire, EMS, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fields, I just want to remind everyone that we do have a couple other things on the agenda. So I would like to perhaps just blast through the last few pages of this presentation while Mr. Forney is on the line, and then we'll definitely come back to all these issues and more.
Sounds good.
Next meeting. So, Mr. Forney, if you want to just get through how comparison to other states as quickly as possible, and then we will resume this topic next week.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've got four states here that have done something similar. Page 23 or 22, Wisconsin, they have something similar in terms of the cost of living adjustment. They're a very, very well-funded plan. Page 23, Colorado Fire and Police is kind of similar to you. In 1980, they created a new tier, kind of similar to what you did, are doing now, only yours would have been effective to basically everybody hired after 1980. They had fixed contributions. It only paid for a core defined benefit plan, and the board has discretion over the COLA. Page 24, South Dakota, just very similarly, they have triggers like you're putting in that would request corrective actions in terms of cost of living adjustments. Page 25 is Ohio. Now, Ohio is a little different because they're not that well funded. So they went through this reform to try to get plans that were not very well funded to get them better funded within 30 years. And they're now imposing reductions in some cases, including increased contributions. One thing you might find interesting is that Ohio and Alaska, I believe, are the only two states where your retiree health care is included as part of the pension fund. There might be a couple of those, but they're the most, two most prominent. Page 26 is just showing you that the employer contribution of 12% is consistent with other states and localities, police and fire. It's consistent with Wells Fargo or Alaska Airlines to what they provide, what their employers pay for their pensions to their people. And to recap, you know, the big, your big concern, or one concern, is potential future unfunded liabilities. We've done the best we can, we think, to address that. The current Tier 4 DCR does not provide adequate benefits, and this new House Bill 79 proposal is a solid potential solution. And I thank you. I'm happy to take other questions either later or through Representative
Kopp,
as you wish.
Mr. Forney, I assume you'll be available to join us in future meetings?
Yes, depending on the schedule. I'm available on Friday. I'll be listening in at least.
Okay.
But yes, I look forward to it, and then perhaps to other committees as well.
Yes. Representative Fields has a question.
Is there any reason a hybrid plan of this structure would not produce similar benefits for groups of public employees beyond public safety employees? And I do want to state I completely support this bill and believe we have to start somewhere, but is there any reason this wouldn't be a sound approach for broader groups of employees?
Through the chair, the approach would, it would need to be fine-tuned. I mean, there were very specific public safety features that we were able to modify, such as the 25-year with no age requirement. So, yeah, it could work where you have a new tier for either teachers or other PERS that's not as good as the old defined benefit tier and has similar triggers and safeguards. That could work.
Thank you.
Mr. Forney, it seems that this plan is it eliminates a lot of the risk. If the returns aren't so good, there's ways to get higher employee contribution and so on and so forth. What if these options are engaged, but then later the return is better? Is there sort of another switch that kicks more benefit back in? Is, you know, it could, there was a, one of the plans from the other states had a it seemed like a section that if there's favorable returns or you know, the tide turns the other way, that could be an increased benefit.
Mr. Chair, what we would envision is that the increased contributions get reversed. So if an employee, if it's bad, the employee's rates go from 8 to 9, and then a few years later it's in good shape, the 9 would go back down to 8% contributions. The COLA that's suspended, there's no mechanism that restores that COLA retroactively a few years later. But, you know, presumably they've learned to live on a lesser increase than they were expecting. But the other thing, of course, is legislation. You know, if 15 years from now, instead of having returns, you know, a little bit worse than expected, we had returns a little bit better than expected, I guess the legislative, I mean, it would be legislative. You could go back and perhaps restore some of these features. Although I got to tell you, I'd be very careful before I started restoring too much.
Sure.
The plans got in a lot of trouble in the late 90s when returns were booming and we thought we were going to be in nirvana forever. California in particular made excessive increases to the police and fire plans, and they're still paying the price 25 years later.
I think Alaska's familiar with that concept.
Sadly, yes.
Representative Hannon, and then we're going to wrap up this portion of the meeting. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fournier, it was my understanding from an earlier presentation that most pension plans do not fund at 100%, that the industry norm, for lack of a better term, is more in the 80 to 85% range is considered a solid prediction of funding plan for a pension system. Can you tell me if that's true and why we were seeking the 100% or 110%?
Through the chair, okay, all plans target 100%. Every plan has as its goal to be 100% funded, because what that means is that the current taxpayers are paying the current cost of teachers or fighting fires or police services or legislators for that matter. And so the goal is to be 100% funded, so you're not shifting the cost onto future generations. While many plans are only about 80% funded, and that is enough to tread water, I think very few actuaries would ever argue that 80% funded is adequate. It needs to be corrected. You can survive for a while, but you're continually shifting costs to future generations if you stay below 100%. Now, 110% is maybe a little bit, greedy. I think that maybe you're not having the best use of taxpayer dollars if you're trying to stay considerably above 100%. So, again, I think 100% is a reasonable target, but anything much higher or lower than that is shifting costs. Either shifting too much cost to current taxpayers if you're going over, or shifting too much cost to the future taxpayers if you're going under.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fournier. Representative Cott, Mr. Westcott, thank you all for coming in. We will be hearing this bill. This week, our meetings are cut short due to subcommittees, but next week we'll be back to full two-hour meetings, so we'll have plenty of time. And again, thank you for all coming in and participating, and I'm going to take a brief at ease.
Agenda. The first is HB 44, automated teller machines fees, and HB 48, temporary state employees and partially exempt service. The first item will be HB 44, automated teller machines, by Representative Ortiz. This is going to be our second hearing on this bill. We got through public testimony on Monday and we closed it. I believe Caroline Hamp from Representative Ortiz's office is here to answer any questions the committee may have. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, hearing no questions, is there any committee discussion? Seeing none, what is the will of the committee? Representative Wall.
Chairwoman Ledoux, I move HB 44, Automated Teller Machines Fees, version 31-LS0223/A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, hearing no objection, that version moves from the Labor and Commerce Committee. And I'm going to please remind everybody to stay after the committee meeting so that you can sign the folder. The next item on the agenda is HB 48, Temporary State Employees and Partially Exempt Service. This will be our second hearing on this bill. I see that Representative Wilson and Ramon Henderson is here to answer any questions. Do I have any questions? Seeing and hearing no questions, I'm going to open up public testimony. Is there any public testimony on HB 48? It does not appear that there's anybody online. And is there anybody in the audience? There's no one in the audience. So I am going to close public testimony. Do we have any additional comments from the committee? Seeing no comments, what is the will of the committee? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Chairwoman Ledoux. I make a motion to move HB 48, temporary state employees in part exempt service, partial exempt service, fees. What?
No.
Anyhow, I move HB 48, version 31-LS0346-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing no objections, that bill is so moved. Remember to stay after we adjourned to sign. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, March 22nd, 2019 at 3:15 p.m. It is now 4:23, and we are adjourned.